to Olive, How to Dance a Riot on the Aesthetics of Struggle. Where'd you go? Olive kept a brief. She's pursuing her PhD at UCLA, and she's a dancer. I'm going to add that for you. Okay. Olive.
No, should I move? I have a two-sentence epigraph from Randy Martin. Politics goes nowhere without movement. It is not simply an idea, decision, or choice taken at a moment, but also a transfigurative process that makes and occupies space. A sledgehammer meets glass. Distant shouts, sirens. The air thick with tear gas and smoke. Shards of glass sparkling on the concrete. Smoldering cars. The streets strewn with objects askew. Bodies running together. Bodies forming packs that spread out into lines and condense again into tight swarms. We view here a riot scene. Riots often employ a familiar set of compositional devices. Bodies circulating in atypical pathways, the spatial displacement of objects, the breaking of brittle surfaces, the burning of combustible elements. Struggles of disparate historical and geographic location have shared this sensuous moment of unrest. I speak of riots and not any other moment within a struggle, as they are the privileged moment of evidence, of witnessing social antagonism, of knowing a struggle takes place. While one can certainly give an account of these moments within a struggle as resulting from a particular calculus of social and material forces, what can one learn from an inquiry into the aesthetic and choreographic character of the riot? An examination of riots in their aesthetic dimension, their shards and ashes, their clamor and mess, their inescapable sensuality, can make evident a set of choreographic operations that mediate between a struggle and its material consequences. This aesthetic inquiry into riots immediately appears suspect, and I would first like to address three critiques of the aestheticization of politics, namely the accusations of mere aestheticism, fascism, and irrelevance. After addressing these suspicions, I note that forms of struggle may depart or decouple from their material impetus, possessing an aesthetic, symbolic, or semiotic quality that draws their performance into a play between mediation and materiality. The insufficiency of a materially accounting for riots enables a turn towards its form, performance, and interpretation. In the space between a purported political ambition and a concrete moment of articulation, between a specific politics and its embodied manifestation, the play and movement of bodies during a riot enact a second-order struggle for legitimacy. Through a detournement of Kant, specifically the free play and purposiveness without purpose one finds within his aesthetics, I propose the riot as a form of free play during which the body becomes crucial to the elaboration of struggle. 1. The aestheticization of politics. To raise questions concerning the aesthetics of struggle will alarm any dutiful reader of Walter Benjamin. Three denunciations usually follow any attempt to aestheticize an event that properly belongs to politics. The first claims that it renders a political event merely aesthetic, imbibed with less social force or relevance than the domain of politics. The second denounces the inquiry as fascist, citing Benjamin's discussion of fascism's subtraction of social content from aestheticized rituals of politics. The third critique simply dismisses it as a non-question, claiming politics have no sensuous or aesthetic dimensions. In order to address the first two critiques, the suspicions of mere aestheticism and fascism, I make use of Jacques Rancière's Metapolitics of Aesthetics. The aestheticization of politics occurs much before any attempt by a Nazi party to fashion a people like a work of art. The ability to partition politics from other aspects of life reflects the operation of aesthetics, which lies at the core of politics. The third attack, the claim that aesthetics remains a non-question for politics, bears further discussion as it pervades various sectors of the left that have fallen prey to the bad faith of improvisation and direct action. The disavowal of aesthetic qualities of doing politics, or the dismissal of viewing political events in light of their sensuous aspects, assumes that struggles have a purely political character that can be severed off from other forces and influences. Material conditions allegedly produce forms of struggle emerging spontaneously and authentically from its protagonists. This determinist position coincides with the critique of voluntarism, claiming that will and agency do not produce struggles that are, instead, attributable to ripe material conditions. A struggle's protagonists do little more than let the forces of history play out. Their aesthetic and choreographic choices are overdetermined. Similar to the improvisational dancer who insists that her moves simply pour out of her body, body, or the modern artist who produces innovation by performing otherness, one can note that the claims to authenticity often mask their use of citation and reiteration. As the discourse of improvised authenticity often cloaks citation, the discourse of direct action cloaks mediation. Usually employed to differentiate from legislative lobbying or policy-directed efforts, direct action supposedly intervenes within a political circumstance without mediation. Yet these interventions have an always already symbolic or semiotic quality, as the targets operationally exceed any concrete site or single circumstance, be they austerity measures, imperialist wars, or any form of capitalist exploitation. The fantasy of direct action assumes that power has a lever, and if one can yank on it with enough force, one can shift the structure of social relations. Direct action as a myth of unmediated material intervention remains in bad faith. Rather than taking at face value either a determinist analysis that casts struggles as resulting from the interplay of material forces, or a narrative of direct action positing struggles as purely strategic, functional intervention, one can view struggles as performative in Butler's sense of the term. Her concept of gender performativity, in which gender identification is always already citational and scripted, can translate to the citational reiterative nature of struggle. Tactics jump from one context to another, often quoting, rehearsing, or restaging a prior moment within a cycle of struggles. The frequent bemoaning of this nostalgia fails to take into account the performativity of struggle as the reiteration and repetition of pre-existing forms perpetually mediated by previous historical and political maneuvers. Just as the artistic genius fails his borrowings and source materials, the grand politics of unprecedented politics, the struggle from nowhere, conceals its ritualized or performative character. 2, the corporeality of the riot. I do not detach or bracket a riot's specific political content and material intervention. I do not speak of all riots, only those that occur within and punctuate a particular struggle or social movement, leaving football hooliganism, sports riots, and shopping mall stampedes out of the frame of inquiry. I must distinguish between two modalities of rioting: a strategic material task and an intervention into a broader scheme of mediation and power, both often occurring simultaneously within an event. Depending on their context, struggles can operate on several different registers, including that of a collective performance with an abstract or symbolic connection to its political content. As the form of the riot can detach from direct material intervention and participate in a broader mediating scheme, its analysis must move beyond a material calculation of its success or failure. While struggles usually emphatically profess their goals, these remain distanced from the particular site of struggle or praxis. A broad set of processes intervenes between the moment of struggle and the professed goal. One must consider the significance of a struggle in a frame wider than whether or not it achieved the professed ends. Did we or did we not roll back the tuition hike? Did we or did we not abolish ourselves as workers or as women? From a broader perspective, the significance of a particular moment of action emerges from the second-order struggle over legitimacy played out amongst bodies in space. The riot entails a set of corporeal maneuvers that act upon the city and also upon the body that exerts them. By physically engaging with the bodies of others and the contours of the city, the riot reciprocally pushes back and molds the body of the rioter. One does not know what it feels like to walk in the middle of the street with a large black mass of people until one does it. The physicality of the riot reshapes an understanding of what is possible within social relations. The city pushes back, and praxis reverses its direction, doubling back to refigure those engaged in a struggle. The perspective of a spectator raises the question of interpretation. In an effort to avoid the anxiety of this hermeneutic question, those involved in a riot often use signage to contain and explain themselves. Without posters, banners, placards, or flyers to explain what the bodies mean, one sees groups of people, perhaps clumped together, perhaps moving in a formation. These corporeal formations do not bear any particular reference in themselves to a political aim or content. The signs must do this work, turning people walking around a building or a circle of people holding hands into a political struggle. Yet the bodies are in no way incidental or expendable, an action with too few bodies, a situation in which the posters outnumber the people, falls short, lacks force, and becomes an embarrassment. A struggle produces two texts simultaneously, the language provided by the signage and the movement of bodies. One does not represent the other, bodies do not act as signs representing the political content, and the signs do not represent the aggregation of bodies. One must look beyond the rallying around a textual signifier to the signification of rallying, to the meaning produced by collective bodies, by social movements as such. In interpreting the riot, one must ask the basic question of dance analysis. What are the bodies doing? Between the text dropped on banners and the official statements made in response to a struggle by an employer, city official, or other representative of the ruling class, a volley of corporeal gestures takes place. Police may enter the scene, moving in formation, hurling gas, firing bullets. This volley and exchange of moves becomes a struggle for the spatio-temporal position of bodies. Who can circulate where and for how long? The dance generated by this struggle for space and time within the imminent conditions of the action itself demonstrates a play of antagonisms at a step removed from the specific content of working conditions on wage labor or tuition hikes, for instance. As a necessary detour away from these political ends, a contestation of legitimacy mediates between the content of a struggle and the corporeality of its articulation. In reading the bodies involved in a struggle, one can observe the action and its repression as a complex joust for legitimacy played out on a corporeal level. A struggle's aspirations for performativity in the Austinian sense, as acting in the world, rests upon the ability of the body to perform and contest regimes of legitimacy that back any particular circumstance of exploitation or domination. The riot presents a form of struggle that collapses the distance between the struggle over a particular content and the struggle over legitimacy. The riot generalizes struggle in whatever direction, engaging with whatever encounters as it moves through space. Not this particular window or car, but whatever window, whatever car. One must attend to the participation of the body in the choreography of the riot and the temporality of its storm and stress. Groups congregate in the wrong space, displacing objects, smashing certain things, exploding others. Police functionaries come from inside and out to grab, tag, and control the circulation of bodies. As power operates in the assemblages of nodes, the dance of the riot involves each body witnessing and enacting a sense of what is permissible and possible within the duration of the action. 3, parties and after parties. Riots often become the object of critique for their excessive spectacles that allegedly distract from actual political work. A position Michael Hart takes in an interview with Paper Tiger Television. This line of critique belittles the riot as a form of political production and posits a more authentic notion of political work or more proper forms of praxis. This notion of doing revolutionary politics properly usually divides either into the invention of new structures for a life to come, such as the speculation about or experimentation in anti-capitalist modes of production and reproduction, or engaging in unmediated class struggle. The distinction between these two lies in conceiving of communism as either a positive project with a new mode or method of collective existence in the wake of value production, or as a negative project, the negation of everything existing. Ultimately, any articulation of proper political praxis must return to the embodied moment of struggle, which returns these proper forms of politics to the body and its movements. One cannot abstract struggles from the concrete moments of their elaboration, their performance in space and time. A distinction between sober political praxis and the ecstasies of the riot hinges upon the multiple senses of the party. Inside the form of a calculating political party rests a dance party, an embodied play of social antagonisms. Following the vanguardist political party comes the after party of disorganized struggle, or the riot. One can note the parallel between the riot and a party in its sense of revelry and festivity. Both the party and the riot bring bodies together for a concentrated collective experience, leaving in their wake messes, a disorganized array of bygone use values. If one can think of the riot as a dance party, one must consider the moment after the riot when everything is a mess, the city turned into a ruin of itself. The question of whether the mess created by the riot will remain the next day or workers recover its tracks rests upon the complex dance of legitimacy. 4, the free play of the riot. What would it mean to view forms of struggle in these terms, framed not by specific political content, goal, or ends, but as a second-order struggle for legitimacy? One would look not for an external political goal, but at the movement of bodies within the dynamics of an action. Rather than connecting rising food prices or the tripling of university tuition to smashing a pane of glass, populating or holding a space, or overturning a car at random in the street, the analysis turns to these moves, the task performs by the body. In a detournement of Kant, specifically his concepts of free play and purposiveness without purpose, I propose the riot as the free play of political forces, arousing an experience of the beautiful. Kant's judgment of the beautiful can translate to the relation of the rioter to the urban landscape. The rioter does not interact with the newspaper box, trash can, or shop window for their functional properties or their pleasing qualities. She does not intend to put something in the trash can, obtain a newspaper from its box, or admire the objects displayed in the window. Rather, she interacts with the elements of the street scene with a purposiveness without purpose. She acts as though she has a purpose, taking a brick to the glass or tilting the newspaper box on its side, yet ultimately these actions serve no particular function. The rioter resembles a dancer performing a task-based choreography such as Anna Halperin's Parades and Changes, in which dancers move objects decisively around the stage and tear up rolls of butcher paper to no specific end. The riot becomes a scene of free play of cognitive faculties, an experience of the urban environment disinterested from its relation to either desire or goodness. The street becomes not a conduit of commerce, but a play of forms. Certainly, Kant's notion of the beautiful shares some features with the riot and not others, such as disinterestedness and the sensus communis. This appropriation of the beautiful stems not from a fidelity, but an attempt to read with Kant against Kant. While the connection between urban unrest and a Kantian free play appears out of joint, as the beautiful involves a restfulness of the mind and an experience of harmony, one finds an example of this aestheticized praxis within the writing of T. Kuhn. In its Introduction to Civil War, Thesis 10 states, "Civil war is the free play of forms of life." And Thesis 30 defines communism as the real movement that elaborates everywhere and at every moment civil war. This use of free play gestures towards a reading of communism in light of Kant's aesthetics. T. Kuhn presents a runaway communism that dispenses with any need for concepts of value production or exploitation in favor of a notion of communism as a ceaseless civil war without aim or end, a war fought with purposiveness without purpose. T. Kuhn finds beauty precisely in this elaboration of civil war and communism. As it states, the only beautiful moments of the last century were disparagingly called civil wars. The riot arises out of struggle and unrest, enacting a purposive disordering of the natural universe. A disorder experiences the harmony and beauty of communism's unfolding. T. Kuhn provides one example of communism as an experience of the beautiful. While often privileged as a trope of insurrection, one does not know how seriously to take the riot. Either it falls short of civil war and functions within the predictable logic of the spectacle, rehashing tired derivative moves before the tide of digital cameras, or the riot elaborates civil war par excellence, running, leaping, swarming, and smashing, no particular target and without any particular purpose. In either case, an aesthetic operation occurs during the riot prior to the arrival of any activist marching bands, street theater troops, or art as such. In this investigation of the aesthetics of struggle, corporeal movements mediate between a specific political content and the contestation of legitimacy within the imminent conditions of an action. This aestheticization of politics does not necessarily dilute political struggle to either fascism or mere aestheticism, but rather offers a means to evade the bad faith of direct action, spontaneity, and proper political praxis. Addressing politics on the level of its aesthetic operations forges a connection between the political party and the dance party. As Marx called for the descent from the sphere of exchange to that of production, one must make the descent from the exchange of tactical gestures to their corporeal production, which is to say, to dance.